Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Two Out the First. It is March the 7th, 2023. I am Ryan Balaji. Good to have you here with us. We haven't done a show for a little while, and that's because I've been out of town. As I may have told you if you listen to my other shows or see me on social, I was in Orlando last week. Wasn't there for the Arnold Palmer Invitational. I was actually there for an annual golf trip that I have with my family. We had a great time in Orlando. It is one of the most crowded cities on the planet. I live in Washington, D.C., for crying out loud. One of the worst traffic cities in the world, too. But we had a great time playing golf, loved every minute of it. Back this week to celebrate one of the biggest weeks in golf, which is the Players' Championship. It's the PGA Tour's flagship event, and it is a $25 million designated tournament. And there was a lot of talk today about what the future of the PGA Tour schedule looks like and what all of that might mean for the players that are at the top of the PGA Tour's food chain and those who are not at the top of the food chain. So we have two kind of topics, as the name of the show implies. Let's start with what the kind of outer frame, the framing of what I believe Jay Monahan called the tournament model or performance model or something for this year. He spoke after Rory McIlroy did, who was kind of the player spokesperson here this week. He's put in so much work into, frankly, shaping the future of the PGA Tour. And I think the tour wanted to give him an opportunity to kind of talk through all of that. And we'll talk about some of what he said a little bit later. But I want to get into kind of what Monahan said as he tries to frame, and along with McIlroy, they have talking points together, how this is all going to look. And so it sounds like the 2024 year for the PGA Tour is not entirely enshrined yet. We don't have an entire idea of what the fall is going to look like, but that will be kind of its own thing. But it won't be necessarily what it sounded like it was going to be heading into this season. Come back to that in a second. But what does calendar 2024 look like? Well, the PGA Tour is going to continue this idea of designated tournaments. And it sounds like there are going to be in the range of 8 of them. And then you're going to have the FedEx Cup playoffs like you did and like you have had in, you know, what, the last 15 years. And then you're going to have the major championship. So you're going to have somewhere in the Players' Championship, of course. So you're going to have somewhere in the area of, what, 9 tournaments, 8 tournaments that are going to be unto themselves, and then you'll have these 8 designated events that are unique unto themselves too. And it sounds like they're going to stay pretty static for a while, if at least for 24. It sounds like there's a longer-term plan potentially taking shape here, but that's not done yet. And so they're going to have this series very similar to last year, and a lot of these events are going to feature limited fields with no cuts. Now, the PGA Tour has said that they're going to range somewhere in the area of 70 to 80 players. There will not be a cut. The purses, as Monahan alluded to today after some questioning, will be probably $20 million again and $25 million for the Players' Championship specifically, and probably stay there for a couple of years, if not continue for 3 or 4 years. And from all of the conversation that seems to be going on behind the scenes, the players themselves will not have to compete in all of them. And that might be a nod to, frankly, the realities of keeping the schedule. But it sounds like the idea is to have 2 designated events in back-to-back weeks. So have players compete in a row and then have 3 weeks where you don't have designated tournaments. So you don't put regular tournaments or non-designated tournaments, wherever we're going to call these moving forward, into the awkward situation of being sandwiched between 2 $20 million tournaments and getting absolutely no buzz, or at least relatively little buzz. And I think the unfortunate situation for the Honda Classic this year was it was a great, enjoyable tournament yet again, but it was stuck between 3 really huge events in 4 weeks, between Phoenix and then Genesis, and then you have Honda, and then you go to API, and now you've got the Players. So really 4 and 5. Honda was kind of the loser there, but it was such a compelling, interesting finish between Chris Kirk and Eric Cole that I think the PGA Tour has realized they kind of had to do this out of necessity just to create a schedule this year, kind of save the tour as they viewed it. Now they're going to try to balance things out here. So they're going to try to have two big tournaments a month, followed by three not-so-big tournaments, and that's going to create a schedule where you're going to allow players to gain entry into the next designated tournament or tournaments based on what they do in the three intervening. So that can mean if you play well in this little stretch, you know, the next five best players get in. The top 50 players from the prior season FedEx Cup will get into every designated tournament that the PGA Tour controls. So that means getting into the second round of the playoffs guarantees you somewhere in the area of $1 million of bonus money, because these tournaments are not going to have a cut. No matter how many players they put in it, 70, 80, whatever that number comes out to be in that range, you're going to get paid, which means you're going to get somewhere in the area of probably about $1 million for getting in that top 50, which is a huge bonus for these players. Now, if you get in the top 50, you're in the field. Then the next 10-ish players are probably going to be based on the current season FedEx Cup points list at that point, when the entry deadline happens. And then you're going to have some kind of top players who get in, maybe a sponsor exemption, maybe not. We're not sure about that. Still maybe TBD there. So that's kind of the framework in which they are going to go after this. And the rationale for having two on, three off, so to speak, is that, first of all, players can commit to two consecutive weeks. So they don't have to go play so much in a concentrated stretch like they did this year, although it may turn out to be that way. But they're going to try to give players an opportunity to take time off and work around the major championships and the players and the playoffs and do all of those things together. They're also not going to have any kind of designated tournament after June. So July is going to be pretty wide open, which means you're gonna have an open championship, right? I mean, that's a quote-unquote designated tournament, but it's not a PGA Tour designated tournament. And I think they're trying to make that distinction here with the way they're terming things, talking about things. They're saying, hey, we've got eight designated events. Then we've got our three invitationals, Tiger, Arnie, and Jack. Then we're going to have the playoffs. Those are their own three things. We're going to have the players. It's its own thing. We're going to have the Tournament of Champions, probably its own thing, although I would consider that an elevated tournament. But these eight other ones are just going to kind of be sprinkled in there somewhere between January and the end of June. So you can kind of start to think about that. And you've got some idea of what those tournaments are going to look like, I think. So if you're going to try to do one basically a month to some months earlier in the year before you get to the major championships, so you're going to have probably the Tournament of Champions. It sounds like the Pebble Beach Pro-Am is going to become an elevated slash designated tournament. It'll take on that moniker perhaps for a year, perhaps for several. We don't know that yet. But the reporting seems to suggest that the money is going that way. And if Pebble becomes a designated stop, then they will turn the Pro-Am competition into either 36 or 54 holes. And they'll limit kind of the viability of that when it's a designated tournament. And if it's in perpetuity, then the perpetuity change is there. And that's just the way that it goes. Then you're going to have Genesis, obviously, is going to be part of it. Then you get into API and the players. Then you're going to get into, you know, the intervening time where you have Phoenix in there and you have whatever is going to replace Honda. You have the rest of the Florida swing. Then you get into April. You're going to have the Masters. Sounds like there's some movement toward making Heritage a permanent designated tournament. I don't know that for certain, but that's kind of the reading the tea leaves there. Then in May, you're going to need a designated tournament that goes with the PGA Championship. Is that one of the Texas tournaments, or does that remain the Wells Fargo Championship as it's going to be this year? Then you get into June, U.S. Open, obviously. Will that be Travelers moving forward as a $20 million tournament, or is this going to be a rotating event, or they rotate slots? We haven't got clarity on that either yet. July, you're going to have the Open Championship, and that's going to be the only designated or elevated or whatever term they're going to start applying to all these things tournament in July. Then you play into the FedEx Cup playoffs, bang, 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 season ends. Sounds like the fall, though, has some more clarity around it, and I think what we're going to find out is you're still going to have some kind of designated tournament in the fall. Maybe one, maybe two, I don't know, but it does sound like the WGC match play is going away. There has been talk that the CJ Cup would like to move into that part of the schedule. Maybe they can do that. We're not sure. maybe the Houston Open would move into the main part of the schedule and perhaps replace the Honda Classic in some fashion, although Jack says the Honda Classic's here to stay, although they're close on a new sponsor, whoever that is. That's TBD. So there's still a lot to work out here, and there still were a lot of questions for Jay Monahan. Why are we going to a series of no-cut tournaments? What is the value of that? Isn't that kind of like LIV? And I think there's some validity to those questions, right? Jay Monahan had a lot of bluster and a lot of things to say last year when LIV started about, you know, being a place of legacy and kind of defining the way that championship golf is played, at least on the men's side, and that cuts were kind of a part of that. Monahan's contention is twofold. One, that Tiger Woods won basically a third, a little bit more than a third of his PGA Tour events in no-cut events, about a third. That means the greatest of all time and the guy most influential perhaps in this process, outside of Rory McIlroy, has no problem winning no-cut tournaments. He dominated the WGCs. He dominated tournaments where there was a limited field. And no one seemed to have any problem with that back then because it was Tiger freaking Woods. Jack Nicklaus and Arnold Palmer won a bunch of tournaments in their careers that were no-cut affairs. Now, I think the numbers from the PGA Tour aren't quite accurate because they had a bunch of ready-made numbers basically saying that a fourth of Jack's wins, or about almost a third of them, were no-cut events. I'm not exactly sure about that. And that Arnie's were somewhere in the area of about a fourth of his victories were in no-cut events. Again, not entirely sure about that. Haven't back-checked all of that because I don't remember what the makeup of PGA Tour events looked like in 1962, but I don't think it's quite that high. Still, a significant number of tournaments with both of those legends' resumes were no-cut affairs. And that's fine. And the other point of contention is that the cut for these tournaments is really the FedEx Cup playoffs. And so if you get into those, or the cut is the current FedEx Cup playoff standings, or the cut is how you did in the last three non-designated tournaments to lead into this next designated one. So he's trying to say, hey, you play your way in, and if you play your way in, then you've made the cut, so to speak, and then go from there. And I guess I can kind of understand that. It's maybe a different way of presenting that, a good talking point, I suppose. I frankly don't think a whole lot of casual fans care at all about no-cut events. They just want it to be compelling and interesting. And if they are those things, then they'll watch it. And I think we get a little too mired for people who are extremely online about golf, particularly professional golf, that you know every fan thinks the WGC stunk and that they didn't like the makeup of the fields. I'm here to tell you that most people don't have any idea who plays golf week to week beyond like the top players. And they don't care. They just want to see the best players together as often as humanly possible. And if the PGA Tour is delivering that, then they are delivering what the fans want. We can disagree about whether that's good for the game, whether that's reverential toward the history of it, all those types of things. Happy to have that conversation. It's going to be a multi-year one. But in the meantime, the PGA Tour is trying to figure out a way to get its best players together more frequently than they had in the past. This model does help achieve that. And they contend that this model will also help the non-designated tournaments because it'll serve as a gateway to the designated series. It'll also mean that players who are already in the designated tournaments series, they might want to compete in the intervening three events more often because they don't want to take 3 weeks off between starts. They might only want to take 2 weeks off. Rory McIlroy said as much today. He said he's going to compete in some of these non-designated tournaments because he doesn't want to take 3 weeks off. Sometimes he might want to. Sometimes he doesn't want to. But at least that's a possibility and can set a cadence to the schedule. And I think they've gotten around this idea the last few years before the designated era of having one big tournament a month. Well, now it's two big tournaments a month. And some months there's two big tournaments in 4 weeks, and some there's two in 5 weeks. But that's just the way that it looks. And then July is just the chase to the playoffs. August is the playoffs, so July is kind of an off month, so to speak. And August is the on month. Okay, that's fine too. We can do that. And then they'll figure out the fall schedule and present that in the next several weeks. And they should finally be able to give some answers to the rank and file players who may not as easily qualify for this top 70 and then the top 50 for the playoffs that, hey, here's how you keep your card through the fall or whatever that looks like. We'll get a better handle on that. It also sounds like the PGA Tour is willing to acknowledge that they're going to increase the FedEx Cup points available to the winner of a designated tournament. I saw a number reported today. I don't remember who exactly it was, but I want to say it was Rex Hoggard, that that number will be 700 points instead of the 500 points you get for a standard event. My follow-up question to that is, does that mean the majors go up from 600 to like 1,000 or 600 to 700? Or what does that look like exactly? And I haven't seen that fully squared away yet. So we'll have to kind of see what the big reveal is in the coming weeks and months about that. But it also sounds like not all of this is set in stone, that there still could be some tournaments with cuts that are considered designated events, that there could still be some changes to the schedule. But it sounds like they've got a framework. It sounds like they've got a pretty good idea of what they want to do. And what they've come up with seems to be better for the product, seems to be better for a casual fan. You can see the ratings are up for all of the designated tournaments compared to last year, and substantially so. So if you can come up with an additional 12, 13 times a year using this schedule as an example, where you have the best players getting together and you know more people are going to watch, that's good for the product overall. And if you can use the three non-designated tournaments to get some star power, get some good storylines, maybe it all kind of works out for the best. I could see the argument for having the smaller fields for the designated ones, the full fields for the non-designated ones, and how that can actually work to each other's benefit to a degree. I don't think it's as big of a benefit as they say, but I could see it to a degree. So if all of this sounds good, then the PGA Tour has to consider that there could be a possibility there are players who are interested in coming back to the PGA Tour from LIV. There's been a lot of smoke, a lot of discussion around Brooks Koepka potentially wanting to come back and finding that his move to LIV perhaps was a mistake. I don't know about that entirely. I don't have an inside source at LIV. But if you take that at face value and ask Jay Monahan about it, which he was, Kevin Van Valkenburg asked that, then what does that path potentially look like if there is one? Monahan said, I don't like to deal in hypotheticals, neither did Tim Fincham. He's not going to comment on that at that time, but you know, our stance is our stance. And I think that's important to him because he can't betray the rank and file. He can't betray the players who are loyal to the tour by saying, oh, well, we could open up some doors and see what things happen. That might be a case-by-case basis thing, but now you've built something here with a schedule that allows you to kind of create, frankly, a penalty box for LIV guys, where you can say, okay, you want to come back from LIV, that, you know, that's great, we're happy to have you back, here's your penalty. You can't play in any designated tournament, and you can't play in the FedEx Cup playoffs for some duration of time. And they could say, you can't do that for however many years you're on LIV. You played 1 year on LIV, you're 1 year out of the playoffs and the designated series. If you did it for 2 years or 3 years or however long LIV goes, then you have to do it for that long. And you can only keep your card either by getting into the playoffs, by going through the fall stuff, or by going to Q school. I could also see a scenario where Monahan just says, nobody gets that. You can only go to Q school and get your card back, which would probably be the most cutthroat way of doing this. And frankly, probably the most apt punishment. But I also see a world where the PGA Tour is going to be like, hey, we can get these guys back, finally stomp on LIV and really finish this thing off. We want to do what we can to get them back and cause some additional momentum our way. That could very well be a possibility. Now, I realize we've blended a whole bunch of different things here together on a show called Two Out the First that implies talking about multiple stories, and I completely understand that. But the last quote-unquote story, because there's so much going on with the LIV conversation here, these couple of days of the Players' Championship, because you got Monahan there, now you've got McIlroy because he's talking about the new schedule. Apparently, spent 7 hours in a board meeting on Tuesday ahead of the Players' ahead of Arnold Palmer Invitational, and still almost won the golf tournament, which I think is kind of a remarkable thing. But at the same time, McIlroy I think has kind of been conflicted, where he understands that LIV has some influence. He wants to mitigate that or downplay it to a degree at times. He wants to kind of acknowledge that at others. And I think he's also trying to figure out his own legacy and how it relates to all of that. Does he want to kind of talk a lot about how the work he's putting in, or does he want to let other people do that? Does he really want to talk about his accomplishments while he's doing this? All of those different types of things. And I think it creates some contradictions, but he was asked today, basically, was LIV good for golf? Was LIV good for professional golf? And how much of what has happened can be directly attributed to LIV Golf and what has developed in the last year. And I think a lot of people are taking what McIlroy said into a degree of out of context, not in total context. I won't say out of context. That implies they're mangling it. I think they're missing the entire point. So I'm going to read to you his entire answer, and then we'll talk about it for a sec. So for McIlroy, he's asked this question, and then he says, I'm not going to sit here and lie. I think the emergence of LIV or the emergence of a competitor to the PGA Tour has benefited everyone that plays elite professional golf. I think when you've been the biggest golf league and the biggest market in the world for the last 60 years, there's not a lot of incentive to innovate. This has caused a ton of innovation at the PGA Tour, and what was quite, I would say, an antiquated system is being revamped to try to mirror where we're at in the world in the 21st century with the media landscape and just every, you know, the PGA Tour isn't just competing with LIV Golf or other sports. It's competing with Instagram and TikTok and everything else that's trying to take eyeballs away from the PGA Tour as a product. So yeah, you know, LIV coming along, it's definitely had a massive impact on the game, but I think everyone who's a professional golfer is going to benefit from it going forward. And so I think you kind of put all of that into context, and that's probably a little bit of CYA in the background, not one to give LIV too much credit, but he does have a point here in saying there are a lot of things in the world that can take up our attention. Not just LIV Golf relative to the PGA Tour, other sports. I mean, baseball's making big changes to try to speed up the game, to try to have 20 minutes, 30 minutes faster games, to have a better flow to the product because their audience has aged, like golf's. They want to get more young people watching baseball in a shorter time frame, making a more appealing product to watch on TV and watch in person. Well, the PGA Tour is doing the same thing. Now, they are doing that in response to a competitor, obviously, but from the way Jay Monahan put it, and the way he described his role in this process is more or less that he was the administrator, that he was the go-between, that he was the kind of sounding board as for these top players and what they wanted to do. And he was willing to support that because it's their tour. And I think that leads to a really interesting point, and one we'll wrap up on, which is, yes, I think there are going to be a lot of people who go, well, Phil was right. This was a once-in-a-generation opportunity to modify how the PGA Tour works. But did it have to happen this way? I think is going to be the next question is, did it have to work out? Like, did there have to be LIV Golf for the designated series to happen? For there to be a modification to who gets in the playoffs? For there to be a change in pretty much every facet of tour life for everybody involved? I don't know that it did. And the reason I say that is because, yes, there was a seemingly existential threat from LIV, but it all took, apparently, was 20 or 30 players to decide to get together and work in a common interest instead of trying to work in their individual interest. And that leads me to wonder what Phil Mickelson really thought his influence was at the PGA Tour. And I tweeted about that, and then Phil, not too long after, says to Kyle Porter, who's the guy he likes to respond to, over at CBS Sports, and said that he had, before he left the PGA Tour, had a $1 billion commitment for something like a multi-year deal from a current PGA Tour partner that would support effectively what the version of LIV is, like an elevated series of events that only the top players would compete in and that they would own a piece of, and that Monahan said no to that. And I don't know how true that is. I'm obviously not in the room. And Phil has not always been truthful about everything he's done or said. However, even if that is true, did Phil bring that to the other top players? Did he kind of coalesce or try to coalesce 20, 25, 30 guys, the top guys that would benefit from this? Or did he just go to Monahan and say, hey, I got a $1 billion commitment. Let's do it. And we want to own the series. And then Monahan was like, no. This is not how we do things. This is not how the PGA Tour functions. Get out of here. Or how did that all wind up going down? There's a lot of context missing to what Phil said, of course. But either way, it seems like Phil's believed his influence could have all been self-driven, could have all been just him doing stuff. And if that's the case, then that's totally different than how it worked out in the end, seemingly, for this creation of the designated series. And the initial ideas that came up in Delaware were much more in favor, much more beneficial to the top players. They were going to have 13, 14 of these events. They're at 50, 60 guys. It was going to be almost impossible to get kicked out of the series. These guys were going to make money forever. And they went to the tour and they worked it all out. And the tour basically said, look, we can't do it this way. We know what our modeling tells us, that the turnover should be something like 40% out of the top 50 every year. Let's make it that. We need to have fewer of these so we can save more sponsors on the non-designated tournaments. And it'll all work out that way. It was a project that went from, hey, 30 players, 20, 30 players getting together with a series of ideas that really, frankly, was there to benefit them. And then the tour came in and did their job and said, look, we've got these other 150, 200 guys we got to care about. We got to include them in this in some fashion. We get what you're saying. We concede that, but we need to have this work too. Here's how that's all going to work together. And whatever comes out as the product of all of that is what 2024 is going to look like. So if Phil did that on his own, that obviously wasn't going to work. But could he have convinced 25, 26, 30 other guys to have done that and rallied in the same way? And if he could have, would he have done that instead of going to live? And I think that's a question he will never, ever, ever answer in public. But it's one that's going to be very interesting to me for years to come if he ever hints at what the answer truly is. That's going to do it for us today on 2 at the First. Thanks so much for watching. It's great to be back after a vacation. Big week this week. We'll have shows throughout the rest of the week for you about the Players' Championship, things going on in golf. We have plenty to talk about, as always. If you listen to us through a podcast service, please give us a review. Helps 5 stars would be ideal, but leaving a comment and let us know what you think of the show is always very helpful. If you're watching on YouTube, smash that subscribe button. Give us a like, leave a comment. We would appreciate that too. And if you're watching from anywhere else or listening on any other platform, thanks for doing it. We really appreciate it. We'll be back tomorrow with another show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. This is 2 Out the First, and we will talk to you tomorrow. Have a good one, everybody.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at FreeStyleLibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at FreeStyleLibre.us.